Greetings. I'm going to talk a little bit about me. I'm a writer, but more importantly than that, I am a person who believes entirely in the idea that words make worlds. And that is a seismic statement, and it's a statement that needs a little bit of unpacking. And so the way that I try to do that is simply by reintroducing us to the idea that language is, for all intents and purposes, a borrowed thing. It is a co-opted thing. You learned it by virtue of your parents or whoever raised you first, right? They were the facilitators of that language. And then by extension, your community, your schools, and the adults around you. But that is borrowed. That is not a thing that you own. It is a thing that you accepted as it was given to you without much questioning. And most of us have that relationship with language. For me, the movement toward writing, and really, writing for me is also the thing that catalyzed me finally being whole, being positioned in the world in the way that I wanted to be, with real deliberation. And so there are some things that had to come into me that had to sort of shift my paradigm. In an African-American context, when I say language is a borrowed thing, that is certainly true, but it's true for all of us. There's a phrase that I identified with well into my adulthood that was used to describe me. And that phrase was the descendant of slaves. Black History Month, that is a phrase that is bandied about almost every day, right? The descendants of slaves, the descendants of slaves. I didn't have a problem with that at all. I did not have a problem with the languaging of that at all. Until Prince Harry was visiting the States. This was years ago. And I had the television on. I wasn't really watching it, but I heard it. And when they were describing him, he was described as the ascendant of a king. And when I heard that, there was a necessary juxtaposition with descendant of slave. And suddenly, everything that I knew about etymology became apparent. Because I know that to ascend means to go up from or to be above. And I know that to descend means to be beneath or to come down from. So this is a person who is being languaged as the ascendant of a king. He will rise higher than a king. And I have been identifying with the phrase descendant of slave. I will be lower than a slave. I had a problem with that. And so I had to start interrogating the language in a real way. And what I know is this: English borrows from everything else, right? It borrows from Latin, it borrows from French, it borrows from Spanish. So all of a sudden, all those years of private school, all those etymology classes, now I know how to reinterrogate the language that I've been using. And I discovered very quickly that I had been misusing it all my life. Writing, for me, is about the reclamation of language. And in so doing, it is about the reclamation of myself. It is about the insistence of myself. It is about naming myself and claiming myself and defending myself. I don't want to believe that I know what I'm saying. I want to know that I know what I'm saying. There are all kinds of ways to unpack this. Poetry for me has opened me up to how available language actually is to all of us. And so all of a sudden, words that we use synonymously, it becomes apparent to me that they don't have anything to do with each other. The fact that if I say, this is a nice crowd, it reads for you as a compliment. But if you look at the dictionary, at the word nice, then you find out that it was parented by Latin. Nice comes from nascience. Nascience, as in no science, as in no knowledge. So when you look at it, you get the part of speech, and then you get all of these definitions that are complimentary. Kind, warm, pleasant, sweet, polite. And then underneath all of those definitions, you get its meaning in bold letters, ignorant and wanton. The meaning of nice, but we have defined it otherwise. That was a seismic thing for me to reckon with, that definition and meaning are not the same things. That definition is, in fact, a commentary on meaning. That's huge for me, particularly as a woman of color. The business of identifying myself for myself, the resistance of being misnamed further, historically or contemporarily, begins with me having a different kind of relationship with language. So, part of what I do as a writer is that I'm trying so hard to refresh the bones. There are so many people who preceded me who didn't have the opportunities that I do, the resources that I do, who did not ever have the ability to or the freedom to go and get this information for themselves. So much of the writing for me is about reanimating the bones of those who've preceded me. And in so doing, my hope is that I honor them. There is a piece that I wrote in honor of four little girls who died in the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing in Birmingham, Alabama, 50 years ago, this past September. And so this piece is Birmingham Sunday. I don't know what came loose first. A church is not made for falling in on itself. You don't build them prepared for destruction. You build them thinking about the praise shout, the hand clap, the open-mouthed communions, how many choir members can fit in the pulpit and the stained glass Jesus, even in Birmingham, Alabama, 1963, when you had to account for dynamite. For waterlogged protest marchers blown clean off their feet, they fell like blood-torn right angles to foaming at the mouth police dogs, billy clubs, and batons. If you were a colored girl in Birmingham, you knew how to duck and shrink, how to be a misspelled word, an incomplete sentence, squelched down to sugar-softened press and curl perkiness. Their silence was so loud. Their teeth a locked gate. Their mouths held annual sit-ins for their flame-red throats. The sizzle and spill of every unsaid thing, and it's hard to be so still with all that starshine and playground shimmy in the stretch of our bones, but on Sundays, we get it near right. The mornings roll out in hotcakes and black coffee. Daddy is a baritone down the hall singing hymns. Mama is fixing his tie, then yelling about, hey, get on in here and eat before this food gets cold. And we get to wear our hair down. It will be curled around our ears and stopped with ribbon, and the wild hunger of Jim Crow cannot find us in church, so we're scooting around the kitchen in our pretty white shoes without a single scuff, and our sister gets to dab a little rouge on her cheeks just on Sundays, just on Sundays. And the car ride is a sovereign floating joy, because mama can sing. And she's rolling that pretty bell tinkle soprano out, and we're picking up the chorus where we can. And though we have to keep tugging at our slip so that it does not dip below our dress, we are still everything new and shiny that God has ever loved, and deep and high in our sometime colored girl loveliness, because Jim Crow does not seek you in church. I don't know what came loose first, but when the choir was singing, I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. And you were a wet giggle with your sister in Sunday school. The sky came down and smothered everything. Ceiling tiles flew like occasional birds, smacked the walls and smoldered. Skulls and incandescent smoke, a wild death for a young girl, a valley of broken jawbone, baby teeth scattered like confetti, a stony, vexing sleep. The sun, crazy, was shining anyway. Refugee clergy digging through the rubble, finding tiny limbs, and the world is a singed skirt. I don't know what came loose first, but it all came loose, didn't it, Addie and Denise? Didn't it, Cynthia? Didn't it, Carol? Didn't it drop the winter in? Didn't it catch and keep the sky snatched low by the terrible clang of dynamite? Nobody should offer you a heaven when you hadn't even had your period yet, or been to your first boy-girl dance and had the chance to gossip about it the next day. And nobody can flesh your bones. Your mama will never be the sister who could smile with all her teeth, because somebody lifted a sheet, and underneath it was your bomb-blasted body, and the world broke open and swallowed her whole. Things fall apart. The center will not hold, but do you hear that? Just over all that ugly, do you hear that? Past the thunder crack of grief and go down Moses, do you hear that? Can't no homemade detonated nothing touch it. Just down the street, there is still rough and tumble tag and tea parties. Some little girl is still lemon cookie, hula hoop and hopscotch wonderful, twirling around in her mama's old stitched and restitched skirts, and she's gonna go to church on Sunday singing, I wish I knew how it would feel to be free, and she will mean it. That poem, for me, is my attempt at reanimating the bones, because so much about my experience, my historical before I got here experience, my historical before I had a body or a consciousness experience, is trying to tell me that I'm a conquered person, that I come from defeated people. And I resist that. I reject that. I operate and position myself in the world with the fact of my being and my becoming, with the fact of my whole ancestry for me is rooted in the supernatural. I am so proud of the people whose blood moves in me. It does not tell me that I am a conquered person. It does not tell me that I am a low person, that I am operating from an inferior position. It tells me that somebody that I alchemized from was in the belly of a slave ship, that they negotiated circumstances that are unlanguageable, insurmountable, that should have destroyed them, but that it didn't. Somebody made the seismic choice to stay. And I believe, and I live my life according to the belief, that they did that because they were thinking about me. That somewhere down the line, there would be someone who came from them who could have full ownership of the words that they use, of their lives and their limbs, that their bodies would belong wholly to them, their experiences wholly to them, their lives holy to them. I have a responsibility to such an awesome legacy, and that's how I treat my history. I do not lament it. It's awesome. I have so many opportunities to be amazing. So many opportunities to prove my resilience and my endurance and my brilliance, and I celebrate that. There's one more piece that I want to do that feels appropriate, because in talking about language for women, for people who have been contemporarily or historically marginalized, people of color, there's so many things that can marginalize you. Socioeconomic status can marginalize you. How you pray, who you pray to, can marginalize you. There is a poet, her name is Rachel McGibbons, and she's a dear friend of mine, and she's important beyond her contribution to the craft. She's important because she's an example of what happens when you elect to move the bramble out of your way and insist on yourself. And so I think the last poem that I would like to do is a dedication for her, and it's a new poem, so I have to read it. That's okay though, I'm a good reader. A sometimes for Rachel McGibbons. Listen, woman, you for whom the locusts come have asked a thousand things of your flesh. You, the one who swallowed the fists of broken men, you, having trained the blood to be still, to defy childhood with full hands, the parable of October blood and winter, a death witch in this great wink of eternity, do not ask anything more of your bones. A woman like you is a dangerous thing, and they do not know that when we are little girls, we learn that woman is a ghost with a torn slip, a haunted set of hips and swollen tongue, come to rock the floorboards, a monster with no real mouth. It is an enlisted suffering for being so soft. Listen, some of us will be unholy forever. We, who have clawed the grave with our one good hand, called hell into our bodies, declared war on the humbler functions of femininity, we, who shook heaven loose when we laid ourselves flat, gave birth to boys in our childhood bedrooms, the wild, secluded rolling of our bodies breaking on the end of our father's fists. We, who could have done better with hope and prayer. We, who forgot God. We, who could not find him. We, who could not be content to remain unripe. We, who have been emptied out of coquettish flick of the wrist responses to rape culture. We, always the plaintiffs. We, never the gavel. Sometimes, Rachel, sometimes we give up heaven for the rights to our bodies. We bloodshard and bang at the moon, women, the leprous hand of resilience that snatches our bones loose to make us get up to endure the winter one more time. We know patriarchy is the artwork of a murderer, some axe-wielding woodsman who cursed his mother in between the thighs of every unchristened woman who tried to love him. Here is the prayer we remember, the only one that fits in our mouth. Glory be to God for unkilled things, for the women who refuse to die.